Chapter 72. I can't decide if I'm going to be moved to tears or throw up, Cruxas said.
There's a good reason for that, Tisus said.
The procession into the city wasn't what Kip had expected. He wasn't sure what that had been. It wasn't as if he'd fantasized about being a conqueror. But as his army snaked in through the streets toward the Palace of the Divines, they saw that the city was in a horrific state. It was far worse than they'd been led to believe. Which made sense, Kip realized. A besieged city had every reason to hide how bad things were. Gaunt men and women holding sickly children and limp babies cheered as if to make up with enthusiasm for lacking any tangible way to show their appreciation. But there was a troubling undercurrent here, too. A look on some faces like that of a beaten dog cowering under a raised fist.
They're afraid of us, Kip said suddenly.
It was what Tisus had been hinting.
What?
Cruxa asked in disbelief.
If you let a strange army into your city, how do you stop them from doing whatever they want?
Tisus asked. Kip looked around, sickened. Sad excuses for little banners of welcome waved from open windows and balconies. Instead of the famed living wood that the city was famous for, most of the buildings were built of the white granite that was so plentiful in the area. Everywhere, though, Kip saw the forester's art, from carvings of intricate zoomorphic dogs and tiger wolves to the more typical infinite knots, plaits, braids, spirals, and step-and-key patterns for love, for husband and wife and children and clan, for eternal life, for the relations of nature and man and their gods, for life above and life below, and for life and death and renewal. Despite its power at the time, this civilization had converted with little or no force. Lucidonius's teachings had made sense to these people, as if his ideas filled in the gaps that had left them puzzled, and contradicted only those things in their own practices that had left them uneasy. They had already revered the number 7. Not only did they see it in their colours, but they arranged the world into what they called the 7 creations. Man, mammal, fish, reptile, bird, insect, and plant. But all the grandeur of the city now was tarnished, a mock. Starving people had not the energy to clean their homes and streets, or even themselves. Rubbish heaps had been plundered, and the detritus left scattered about, not least on the faces of these walking skeletons in their rags.
The city wasn't under siege that long, Kip said. It shouldn't be this bad. Are those burn marks on the walls? Were there riots here?
My spies haven't reported yet, Tisus said. I don't know what happened.
Kip looked back at his lackluster parade. Men and women literally blooded, the grime and sweat and soot of the battlefield still on them, some limping, some still bleeding after refusing medical care because they didn't want to disappoint their leader or leave their friends. All marching, to impress whom? A starving crowd? The city leaders? These people didn't need to be impressed, they needed to be fed.
What are we doing? Kip said. A military procession to the heart of the city? Why? Because that's what people do. None of the people here have ever done it or ever seen it. There's a place for spectacle, but it's not here.
Kip threw a flare into the sky to signal a stop. It takes some time for an entire army to stop, though, and while the appropriate people got in their places for further orders, Shabil Shofra said,
I know what you're going to do, and while I admire the heart behind it, Lord Guile, it's not a good idea. Think about the logistics.
I've thought of them, Kip said,
but he didn't explain.
What's he going to do?
Fekudi tried to whisper.
He's going to give away our food, Cruxa said. He's not going to give our food away,
Ben Haydad said,
because that would be idiotic. I'm giving our food away, Kip told Fekudi. Kip, Ben Haydad said, if you give away our food, the army stops, period. We go nowhere, we do nothing. People start leaving within a couple of days. If the army stops, the Blood Robes can kill as many foresters as they want, including everyone in this city. In the long run, it's not a mercy to
give away the food, Kip commanded.
All of it.
Section commanders, carry out the original plan, but begin now and take all of our food rather than what we'd apportioned before. Shabil huffed, and Ben Haydad lifted his heavy spectacles and rubbed the bridge of his nose.
Tell me you've got a plan, Ben Haydad said. Please.
Drafters, cavalry, and the mighty with me, Kip said. I want our camp followers in here mending and washing clothes and cleaning streets. Anything that needs to be done and can be done in 2 days, do it. Looting or assault will earn hanging. Remind them to go in teams. Even killings in self-defense will be considered murder if there aren't 2 corroborating witnesses.
Last thing Kip needed was some young arseholes to antagonize the whole city. The army didn't dissolve at once, of course, but commanders began booming out orders, filling in their people on what they were about to do, and messengers exploded from the column like hornets from an upended nest. Kip gave the signal, and the column began moving again, but now, as it got deeper into the city, sections broke off, each with its own wagons of provisions. It took a lot of work to give away something properly. Gradually, the signs of the city's impoverishment cleared, until they reached the great gate into the part of the city called the Sanctum of the Divines. Here there were undeniable scorch marks from at least one earlier riot. The great gate was now open, though. Here, as at the wall, the posts of the gate were trees, but these weren't Sabino cypresses. They were Atasifusta, though sadly no longer living. Kip hadn't known that there were any left standing in the world. Atasifusta were the only known plant that converted sunlight into something a lot like red luxin, except it was more potent red luxin than man had ever drafted. A single stick of the stuff would burn for many days without being consumed. Its usefulness had doomed it to extinction. Families still passed down single sticks of the stuff. A few shavings made a perfect fire starter, or the whole stick could be set alight to help light damp wood, and then extinguished with no appreciable loss to its mass. It had found worse uses in war, the sawdust being a precursor to black powder. Here, knotwork had been carved into the entire surface of both trees, and the rest overlaid with some clear glaze so the designs stood out in black on bone-white wood. Clearly, the designs were set alight for special occasions. Kip was somewhat sad that his arrival didn't rate. A dozen guards stood at the gate, but they said nothing. A single rider on a white charger in ceremonial white and gold armor and carrying the white and green triangular flag of the city nodded to them from his wolf helm and rode before them, leading them to the Palace of the Divines. Here the buildings were older and grander by far. Living wood made the frames of these buildings, with a few supporting enormous stained glass windows between their branches, mostly hidden now by fresh green leaves, but no doubt glorious in autumn and winter.
"How the hell did they do that?" Ben-Hadad said. "Do they will-cast the trees? How do you will-cast a tree? They don't grow fast enough. How do the windows not shatter when the branches grow year by year? How do they keep the trees alive? It's not possible."
"It's a great disgrace for any family to let their heartwood die," Tysus said. "That said, perhaps we should focus on more immediate matters."
"Such as?" Kip asked. He stopped.
"Oh."
A gallows had come into view. 10 ragged corpses, bedecked with rags and carrion birds, rioters no doubt, were hanged beside a familiar man whose trousers alone would have fed those rioters for a month.
"They hanged Conhill?" Cruxa asked. "But why?"
"Because he offended Kip," Tysus said, shocked. "They're that desperate."
Kip felt a sudden wave of guilt, as when he'd not hidden the money well enough and his mother had found it and gone on another binge. After she sobered, she'd berate him for failing her. Con Hill had been an asshole. Kip had wanted the man out of his sight. He'd guessed the Council of Divines would strip him of his position as Con. But this? What had Kip done? They entered a glorious plaza nearly the size of a hippodrome. It was paved with flawless white granite cobbles, and stately buildings in green and marble embraced by living wood rose on each side of the square. The grandest was the Palace of the Divines, which lay at the top of 30 wine-red marble steps, like a pale, bloated dictator in his palanquin. The Divines, septuagenarians all, stood at the top of the steps in a semicircle. Kip was clearly expected to dismount and climb the steps. He rode up the steps. Don't fall off the damn horse. Don't fall off the damn horse. The horse was sure-footed, though, and it deposited Kip at the top of the stairs in the midst of 7 scandalized old men and their retinues. The mighty had dismounted and flowed up the steps like a black tide. Having made a small point about how he might not do what they expected, Kip undercut it by striking a demure attitude.
"Greetings, my lords," he said with only a tiny smile. "Greetings, Lord Guile, savior of Dawnville, defender of Blood Forest, and loyal son of the 7 satrapies,"
an officious nasally man at one end said. Kip thought it was Lord Edan Appleton from Tysus's briefings. He decided he didn't like the little stuffed turd. The others echoed him. Several looked openly hostile. Good, those he could trust. They also stood together like amateurs, like cattle herding close to ward off harm. A faction, then. After dealings at the Chromaria, it was actually refreshing to see one's friends and enemies do something so kind as to line up so you could tell who was who. Time to stir the pot. There were thousands of people gathered in the square, watching, though of course they wouldn't hear anything that Kip said to the assembled lords. Then again, Kip supposed that after weeks and months under siege, pretty much anything would seem fascinating. Perhaps he couldn't fault them for looking even to him for entertainment. Might as well start out by putting them off balance.
"Good, good," Kip said. "I'm so glad to find you so amenable."
"My Lord Gyle," Lord Edan Appleton said, "we would like to present you..."
"I don't really enjoy ceremony," Kip said, "so let's skip all that. I see you've hanged that asshole, what's his... Hill, Con Hill, wasn't he? Was that for me?"
They looked at each other, and some of the gazes were hateful. The hateful three of the wimpy herd were Lord Hila de Rathcor, nephew of Orea Pelor, Lord Breck Whiteoak, third cousin of Caris Whiteoak, and Lord Cuan Spreadingoak, grandson of Prism Gracos Spreadingoak and a kitchen maid. Kip guessed that they'd been allies of Con Hill. With him dead, their majority on the council had dissolved.
"We simply respect you so much that we wish to make your time here before you take your army to Greenhaven as easy as possible, my lord,"
Lord Coolin Willowbough said. He did an unconvincing job of looking mournful at the demise of his rival. "Or Holland's beard, I really am in a backwater. This is what passes for the nobility here?"
"I appreciate that," Kip said. "He was a bastard. I don't know if I could have worked with him. I'd like to reward whoever's idea it was. I imagine Con Hill had some lands and titles one might redistribute to the worthy."
"We don't often punish a whole family for one man's miscalc,"
Lord Cuan Spreadingoak said.
"You don't often do a lot of things. I think good work should be rewarded fairly, don't you agree?" Kip asked.
We all agree it should be done,"
Ku Kuan said, speaking for the first time. He was white-haired and pale as the dead, a look accentuated by figure as lean as a rapier.
"Well, I'm not going to split up lands that have a history and a people. Satrap Willowbough will already be irritated with me for this redistribution without his consent. He and I have bigger things to discuss, but I needn't rub it in his face. I know it wasn't any of them," Kip said, pointing to the huddled three. "They look angry and scared. Friends of his, no doubt."
"Not friends, per se," Lord Breck said.
The others glared at him.
"It was my idea,"
Lord Ku Kuman said.
"He's not jumping on the credit where he oughtn't, is he?"
Kip asked Lord Willowbough and Edan, as if it were funny.
"We agreed readily,"
Lord Edan said.
Lord Ku Kuman came from the smallest and weakest family on the Council of Divines. He had no doubt seen this as his big chance to move up.
"This wasn't part of some internal politicking, was it?" Kip asked.
"This was really for me?"
"Yes, my lord,"
Lord Kuman said. A flicker of doubt crossed his face, but it was too late.
"A gift."
"Hang him," Kip said.
The words hit the rest, like a grenade in the face, as the mighty grabbed the man.
"Irritating me is not a hanging offence," Kip bellowed, "but murder is."
"What are you? You can't do this,"
Lord Ku Kuman said.
"What do you think, you're Gavin Gyle himself? You're a goddamn child. You can't do this."
Kip tilted his head. "Funny," he said. "This city must be special indeed, because I hear a dead man speaking." Big Leo and Ferkuri dragged the lord down the steps bodily.
"Stop," Kuman shouted. "Fine, it wasn't for you. We had a feud with the Hills. Colm had ruined my sister 10 years ago. They were engaged to be married, and he could have made peace, but instead he—"
"And you thought to use my coming as a cover for your vengeance," Kip said.
"It was my only chance. The Hills were stronger than us. They were going to get away with it."
"Like you almost did," Kip said from the top of the steps.
Everyone always has a good reason why the law shouldn't apply to them. Quietly, he said, "Lords Appleton, Willowbough?"
"Yes, my lord,"
they said quietly.
"You lied to me."
"We said nothing,"
Lord Willowbough said.
"Indeed," Kip said. "You let him lie to me, and you stood by silent and hoped it would benefit you."
We weren't really lying," Lord Appleton said.
"Oh, let me guess, you were just pulling my leg."
They said nothing.
"Then now you can pull your friend's leg. One on each side."
They looked at each other like they didn't understand.
go, Kip said. Pull his legs to help him strangle quickly. He almost made you richer and more powerful. It's the least you can do in return. Less than a minute later, in utter silence, a noose was thrown over the gallows and tied to a saddle. With his hands bound behind his back, Lord Kukulcan was lifted from the ground by his neck. His legs kicked and flailed until Lord Willowbough and Lord Appleton each grabbed one and hugged it to their chests. Lord Kukulcan tried to kick them free. The body wants to live. But they held on, throwing all their weight into it, and his neck cracked and elongated. A dark stain blossomed at his groin and spread down to where the lords held him, eyes clenched shut as if they hadn't felt all the fight go out of him, nor did they feel the warm wetness for several long seconds. They stepped back, revulsion and horror painting at their faces, and then again as they took in Kuman's head bent too far to one side, his neck inhumanly long. Kip beckoned them back, and they came, painfully aware of the massive presence of Big Leo and Farcudi. The crowd was still as a tomb. Strangely, it hadn't seemed to even occur to any of the nobles to try to call forth the city's own fighters to defend them. Not that it would have done them much good, but these nobles were men who couldn't even conceive of their privileges being abrogated, or on what those privileges rested, so they had no mental recourse when they were. The lords rejoined the circle, holding their hands out, disgusted by the foulness they'd touched and done, but unwilling to wipe them on their clothes. Rich men, then, but not so rich as to defile their finest clothes. Kip said, "I'm going to tell you how things are going to be, and you are going to surprise me with how quickly you make them happen. Do we understand each other?" He didn't wait for an answer. "Here's what's first." And on Kip's orders, the family of each of the seven brought forward its chief accountant, or secretary. Kip had 14 horses, saddled and waiting. In front of him, so that the lords could send no secret message, each was ordered to go to his employer's home or business and retrieve all his account books. He gave no more detail, and each was paired with a trained accountant from Kip's camp. With no idea exactly what Kip was looking for, and no time to forge accounts, it would at least minimize the ability to obfuscate. Before the accountants left, Kip said, "Oh, and if you're not back in 1 hour, both you and your lord hang. No excuses."
This is preposterous,
Colin Willowbough said. He was a distant cousin of the satraps.
Yes, that I should need to do this is an outrage, Kip said.
He turned sharply to the accountants, who were frozen, wondering if his command would be called off.
1 hour minus 1 minute, he said.
Shall I shave off another 5 minutes for impertinence? They galloped off in every direction.
This is most upsetting, Lord Guile,
Lord Goldenbriar said. His moron son, Donal, had set a trap for the blood robes at the earthworks of Martis. The ambush had been turned back on them, and 5,000 of his men were massacred in the muddy maze. He was new to the Council of Divines, brought in only hours ago to replace Con Hill. Doubtless he was on the side of Willowbough, Appleton, and Corman. But he hadn't been around long enough for Kip to hold him responsible for anything.
"For that, I apologize," Kip said. "But the problems here are significant, and you seem to be a people who appreciate the value of sharp action. Are you not?"
I suppose,
Lord Goldenbriar said uncertainly. "Your friends hanged a man within a couple of hours so you could be brought onto the council to change the balance of power in a city. That's sharp action," Kip said.
"Yes," Lord Goldenbriar admitted. "It is, my lord."
He didn't look afraid, and Kip wondered for a moment if he'd hanged the wrong man. But then Kuman had confessed to murder, and you can't hang men simply for being dangerous. Or you can, but you have to give up any pretense of morality if you do.
"I want to know where all the food is," Kip said.
"Food?" Lord Appleton asked, as if he hadn't got it through his head yet that Kip wasn't a moron. Kip said,
"I understand hoarding food to take care of your own family and household in uncertain times. At some point it gets venal and cruel to your neighbours, but I understand it. But when you've got so much set aside that you have no fear of starvation, but instead you're using that food to enslave your neighbours, making them trade their own children and their own bodies for a crust of bread, for that I have no patience."
"There's no law against being wise enough to buy food before a siege."
"No," Kip said.
but I dare say there are laws against hoarding it and then using your votes as councillors to buy it back from yourselves at ever-inflating prices. We call that corruption where I'm from.
We've done nothing illegal, Lord Cullen Willowbough said.
Considering that you've written the laws in this city and that Satrap Willowbough is probably incapable of providing oversight on the lacing of his boots, that may actually be true, Kip said. Your ledger books will tell us that.
Those books are private, Lord Willowbough said.
It had been Tysis who'd given Kip the idea of inspecting their books originally. They'd planned to do that regardless. A marching army needs food and supplies, and the nobles they liberated would have every incentive to underreport what they had available. It was Ferkudi who'd been puzzled by the scout's reports that the city was desperate. This was a rich area that had had a long, long time to prepare for the Blood Robe's arrival. Kip had been shocked only at how bad things had gotten, how callous these rich men had become to the suffering of their own people. The plan had always been to spring these changes on the Divines as if Kip were coming up with them off the top of his head. That was the only way to make sure they got no word of it beforehand. They wanted to see him as young and impulsive. He'd play that happily enough with one tiny twist. He was young and impulsive, and therefore dangerous. "Here's what's going to happen," Kip said. "You're going to give me all the food you've stockpiled and half the coin."
"Ha!" said Lord Goldenbriar. "You'll have to hang all of us before we agree to this outrage."
"Oh, I'll hang you if I must," Kip said. "But first I'll let it be known to the whole city that you've stockpiles of food and coin in hidden rooms in your houses, and that no soldiers or guards are present to protect them."
"That's not true,"
Lord Appleton said tightly. He believed Kip now.
"We would never put ourselves at such risk.
But thousands of starving, angry people won't know that, will they? The mobs will tear apart your homes, steal everything they can lay their hands on, and then likely burn them down when they find no food. I should think your families and any servants on the premises won't fare well either. Heart trees will be cut down before your eyes. In the aftermath, new noble families may well have to be chosen." And finally, true fear began to trickle into their piggish little eyes.
"You wouldn't," Lord Willowbough said. "You're one of us. You wouldn't turn your back on fellow lords. One of you."
"I'm one of them," Kip said, pointing to the starving hordes, "just in nicer clothes. The entire reason your class exists is so that when your city falls on hard times, you're there to feed the starving and protect the vulnerable. In return for that, in peacetime and in plenty, you're allowed to enjoy the fruits of excess. But you've not kept your bargain. You've not just failed your basic purpose, you've betrayed it. You've torn down this city and exploited its people when they needed you most. So this is my mercy. And it's the last mercy I'm going to offer you." And like that, they were broken.
Cuan Spreading Oak and Lord Healer Cheirathcor actually looked ashamed of themselves. But it was Lord Goldenbriar, the conniver, who hit his knees first. Even connivers have their place. The rest dropped to their knees in submission, and Kip pressed on because Andros Guile had taught him something. A hard push does the most when a man is already stumbling backward.
"And here's my first decree," Kip said. "Don't stand until you consent. Anyone enslaved in the last 90 days will be freed immediately. In addition, we're now enforcing the old slave code. Anyone caught taking a slave or snipping a child's ear will face death. Families will not be split. Children born to slave parents will be born free and entitled to a freedom price when they reach majority. If you can't produce papers for any slave currently owned, they'll be manumitted. Period. Of those still in bondage after all this, their papers will be revised to show that on the 7th year, the year of Jubilee, they'll be granted freedom. That's 5 years from now, in case you've forgotten. Plenty of time to adjust to the new reality. Copies of the new contracts will be signed and witnessed by a magistrate and a Luxiat and be filed here and with the Chromeria."
Lord Goldenbriar, still looking at the ground, whispered,
"Are you insane?"
"Idealistic. It's a near cousin."
"We could resist," Lord Goldenbriar said. "We might not win, but we could stain your image irreversibly. The Lysach is supposed to be a uniter."
"I've never claimed that title," Kip said. "I'm just another man trying to protect his people. But others have claimed that name for me, and imagine their fury at you if you try to tarnish it." A silence stretched out. Then, like a weed too long in the pitiless sun, the man shriveled and wilted.
"My lord,"
Lord Goldenbriar said,
and he reached out his hand to touch Kip's foot in submission. And just like that, Kip had a city, and his army had food.